Order the Rules Committee today, and it's nice to have such a wonderful audience. There's so many nice people here. We appreciate that. The order, as you know, gets moved around a bit depending on who's here, and we have an esteemed senator with us today, so we're going to open up a public hearing on SJR 16A. And with that, we'll have a short explanation by our administrator and our
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. SJR 16A expresses legislative support for efforts of the Ecumenical Patriarch to promote the peaceful coexistence of Christians and Muslims in the Republic of Turkey. Requests the Republic of Turkey uphold and safeguard religious and human rights and grant to the Ecumenical Patriarch appropriate rights and independence in perpetuity. Established in 33 AD in what is now Istanbul, Turkey, the Ecumenical Patriarch of Constantinople is the leader of Orthodox Christians around the world. The Ecumenical Patriarch has been a religious presence in the state of Turkey since its establishment in the 6th century. However, the government of Turkey does not recognize the use of the term or title ecumenical for any religious activity, instead regarding him as the spiritual leader of a Greek minority. Turkish government has taken measures to weaken the institution of the Ecumenical Patriarch through the denial of legal identity, confiscation of church and other properties, and replacing the Patriarch with a state-controlled church entity called the Turkish Orthodox Patriarch. Human rights groups have protested against the conditions placed on the secular government of by the secular government of Turkey on the Ecumenical Patriarch, citing the actions taken by the Turkish government against the Patriarch as violations of Article 9 of religious freedom of the European Convention on Human Rights and Articles 14 and 37 to 45 of the Lausanne Treaty regarding minorities. Human rights groups have also identified the failure of the government to protect the welfare of the Ecumenical Patriarch, who has been the target of bomb attacks in 1993, 95, or 94, 96, 97, 98, and 2004, and prevent the desecration of patriarchal cemeteries and personal assaults against the Ecumenical Patriarch. These groups are calling for intervention from the European Union, European Court of Human Rights, and other governments on behalf of the Ecumenical Patriarch to prevent the dissolution of the Ecumenical Patriarch. Senate Joint Resolution 16A urges the government of Turkey to recognize the Ecumenical Patriarch as a legal personality, cease persecution of religious minorities, and recognize and uphold the human rights of the Ecumenical Patriarch and its followers.
And with that, Representative Senator Starr, sorry about that.
Thank you. Thank you very much. For the record, I'm Bruce Starr. I'm the state senator from District 15, representing Western Washington County. I appreciate the opportunity to testify in Senate Joint Resolution 16. I appreciate the courtesy, Mr. Chair. This is relatively simple bill that passed the Senate unanimously a few short days ago. This bill simply requests the Republic of Turkey to uphold and safeguard religious and human rights as it relates to the Ecumenical Patriarch of the Orthodox Christian Church, the world's second largest Christian church. This resolution is modeled after similar resolutions adopted in 22 states and currently pending in 9 other state houses throughout America. Specifically, the resolution requests that Turkey recognize the Ecumenical Patriarch is, in fact, ecumenical, which includes acknowledging its transitional status independent of Turkey. Also, the resolution urges the Turkish government to cease its insistence that the Ecumenical Patriarch be a Turkish citizen. This position by Turkey is akin to the Italian government requiring any future Roman Catholic pope be born on Italian soil. It is a position that's inconsistent with religious freedom and promotes discrimination. Furthermore, it jeopardizes the very future of the Ecumenical Patriarch of the Orthodox Christian Church because there remain only approximately 2,500 Orthodox citizens in Turkey, most of whom are elderly. Finally, the resolution insists Turkey cease its practice of confiscating the Ecumenical Patriarch's properties, including an orphanage, a hospitals, and theological schools. Colleagues, it's about religious freedom, and I'd urge an aye vote. It's maybe not the most important piece of public policy that you're going to consider today, but I do ask that you take swift action and move it directly to the floor for a due vote, pass vote. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jack Esselman. I'm appearing today on behalf of the 8,000 members of the Greek Orthodox community in Oregon. We urge your passage of Senate Joint Resolution 16 for the reasons outlined by the Honorable Senator and your committee administrator in the name of religious freedom and tolerance.
Any questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you both. Is there anyone else here that would like to testify? That's all that are signed up, and if not, we'll take action now and move this along. So we're going to close the public hearing on SJR 16A. We're going to open a work session on SJR 16A.
Mr. Chair, I move SJR 16A to the floor with a B adopted recommendation.
Representative Edwards moves SJR 16A to the floor with a B adopted recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, we'll have a roll call vote.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Excused.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
Excused.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Roman?
Aye. Motion passes and it heads to the floor. What is there anyone here who would love to carry this bill? If not, I would be honored. So I will carry the bill.
Representative
Girard. Thank you very much. We're going to close the work session on SJR 16. And let me see, are there other representatives or people in the audience?
Clem is here.
Representative Clem. Okay. So, Bill Munson. We're going to open a public hearing on 3004, HB 3004. And you can both come on up. And we'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, House Bill 3004A provides that foreclosure and sale by the trustee of residential property precludes further action for a deficiency against homeowners on any additional trustee for the property given as security for an obligation with certain exceptions. Declares an emergency, it's effective on passage. You have two sets of amendments before you on this matter. The Dash 11 expands debt protection to conclude action against homeowner for debt owed to beneficiary in the residential trustee that was subject to foreclosure that was incurred to secure the residential trustee and other debt incurred to finance a portion of the purchase price of the foreclosed property. Removes the prohibition on action against the homeowner after foreclosure if person bringing action did not foreclose, did not receive proceeds from foreclosure, and was not the trustee or beneficiary in the residential trustee that is foreclosed. Such claims would be permitted. The Dash 12 requires the trustee to provide amended notice of sale upon registration or certified request for any member of the Oregon Bar Association. Permits such notice to be accomplished by internet posting of the copy of the amended notice of sale. Makes a number of non-substantive minor language changes in conformity with modern use.
Okay. With that, we'll also Art Cummings. If you want to come on up, you can be there as well. We've got three chairs, and that's the whole group of people that have listed to speak, so I might as well expedite it. So with that, Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, I'm Brian Clem, state rep from here in Salem. Art and Jane Cummins are constituents of mine who have a daughter who kind of ran into the situation that this bill is intended to address and came and chatted with me about it in the summer, and I introduced the bill at their request. It's really quite an extraordinary situation, and we've got a really great opportunity to help Oregonians. Pleased to recommend to you the Dash 11 amendments, which I've worked on with the United Financial Lobby, to sort of limit exposure for lenders who, through no fault of their own, ended up with some mortgages that in this particular bill were trying to assist the home buyers from getting relief from some practices that border on predatory, but certainly are not intended to be something that someone has already lost their home and they've been foreclosed on, and our intent in this state had not been to have them carry a burden around for the rest of their lives for a portion of the debt that was used to buy the home. Oregon has a law that says if you bought the home, and they you don't make your payments, the lender has to foreclose on it, and they sell it. If they sell it for a loss, they've already got the home, so you're forgiven of that deficiency between what you purchased or what you still owed on the mortgage and what they sold it for at foreclosure. The problem was, I'm not sure we envisioned that there might be multiple mortgage used to buy the home in the first place. And we're not talking refinances later on a second mortgage. We're same lending institution making two loans to get you to your purchase price. So that's the nature of the situation. This amendment makes it clear that the parties that made the loans that would be affected are an institution that they made both loans, or if it's one of their sort of affiliates, and we've got some language in here that describes that, and I'll let Tim talk about that. The other key reason this bill was already on the House floor and we sent it back to kind of get a couple other things right, get this part right on limiting the exposure for the lending community down to, you know, what I would call the guilty party in this situation, but that's up for everyone else to decide. The key feature that's at the back of the bill is this applies to even loans and foreclosures that have already occurred. So this would be debt forgiveness going backwards for Oregonians. Now, the courts may not allow much of that to occur due to contract law and other things. This gives the opportunity for Oregonians who are right now being hounded for debt that they really probably shouldn't have. And they would have the opportunity to have their day in court under this bill. And if the courts say it's too late, you signed the papers, it was in there, you know, that's the situation. But this gives an opportunity to it's not necessarily thousands of Oregonians, but a chunk of Oregonians who have millions of dollars worth of debt that they've already lost their homes and they should no longer have.
Should we get the others first?
Go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association, and as Rep. Clem mentioned, also part of the United Financial Lobby. I want to thank Rep. Clem for working with us on this bill, as well as you, Mr. Chairman, who have scheduled and rescheduled this several times over the past couple of weeks. We are indeed very pleased to be working with Representative Clem to try to get the language correct in the bill. That's very important going forward, obviously. And I would report today we're still not quite there, even with these amendments, but with your indulgence, would continue that effort. And also, I think Representative Clem is supportive of continuing that effort on the Senate side. So I'd be happy to go in as much detail as you want, but I would just leave it at that we are supportive of continuing our efforts on this legislation.
Have you looked at the dash 12s as well?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we have, and that's not an issue to the lenders. I know it is to a particular group, and we have no objection to those amendments.
Okay. We'll hear the whole panel and we'll have some questions.
Thank you. My name is Art Cummins, and as Representative Clem indicated, my daughter was, adversely affected by the law as it presently stands. We have some written testimony that we gave to the earlier committee on consumer protection, and I assume that's come forward to you all, so I don't want to repeat all of that today about what happened. And I think, Representative Edwards, you contacted my daughter through your office and got some information further on that. I kind of have two hats. I'm a practicing attorney. And I also represent Consolidated Legal, which is a legal plan that's available to employers to provide to their employees in the state of Oregon, and other rather large organizations have this available, and many people in the state of Oregon, the government, all of the counties, cities, Nike, et cetera, subscribe to this plan and make it available to their employees. And I'm kind of the attorney in the valley that gets the referrals. So I was asked, I think it was Representative Holvey, asked me if I had some idea as to how many inquiries came into my office, just as an example, so we could get some idea as to how many people are affected by what happened in between 2005 and 2007. And I went back and looked at my books, and I determined that I had seven inquiries come into my office, all of whom are standing by waiting to be sued on this second note for as much as anywhere from $20,000 to $50,000. And, of course, as you all know, the statute of limitations in contract cases gives them 6 years to pursue that. So they're going to be these people, these first-time home buyers in every case, you know, the American dream, to whom loans would never have been given with conventional practices, are going to be waiting for 6 years for this lawsuit to come down. What I counted were five from the Cottage Grove, Eugene area, and I know there are more than that out there, one in Salem and one in Woodburn that have come to me. So at this point, with the amendments and whatnot, in my view, 11 covers the problem, and particularly the paragraph 2C, where it talks about any financing that incurred to finance the purchase price of the property. That's the key. Not a subsequent equity loan, not a subsequent improvement loan. They're safe. It's those companies that came in who could not make the deal in the first place without making two loans or three loans so the person could get into the house. And typically, the first loan was interest only. The second loan was principal and interest, but at a level that they could afford with a working husband and wife, with a balloon like 5 years down the road. You know, the economy's great. Everything is wonderful. There won't be any problem refinancing in 5 years. Those are the kind of representations that were made to these first-time home buyers. And they bit. And now they're losing jobs and things like that, and they've lost their home, and now they're waiting 6 years for the big lawsuit to come. And $50,000 on somebody who barely makes minimum wage, it's just going to put them into bankruptcy, and Oregon's bankruptcy filings are way high already. They're just going to go higher, assuming that they can qualify. So if you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them with any of my three hats.
Representative Girard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tim, is this what they call short selling?
No, this basically are, as was described earlier, generally 80-20 loans, okay. 80% on the first and then 20 on the second.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Berger. As usual, gentlemen, I was not on any of the committees. I'm walking into the middle of a conversation. What exactly is the remedy that this Dash 11 gives to these people?
So, Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, the Dash 11s say that the treatment under Oregon law that would apply if you had only done one loan, which is you're forgiven of that deficiency, would be the same if you were under two or more loans as well. And then the provision applies retroactively to people who are currently in this situation right now waiting for that letter saying, we got the house, now you still owe us $50,000. And there's some court cases where the courts described that the 2009 Oregon Legislative Assembly really needs to fix this loophole. And that's what we're trying to do.
Representative Berger, follow up.
Further question. Mr. Martinez, your organization is not totally satisfied, but your testimony was that the Dash 11s would get it to the Senate, and that's your goal? Or what exactly was your comment?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, as I mentioned, Representative Clem has been very willing to work with the financial lobby as we go forward on this bill. Our concerns is that we don't believe the language is quite there yet, and what we're trying to make sure is that if on the 80-20 that loan has those loans were made by the same institution or the same lender, and that if down the road those loans are split so that one is sold and the other is retained or they're both sold, that the law no longer would apply, this new law would no longer apply.
And it's your goal to get that language nailed down?
Yes.
And you don't object to that, Representative Clem?
The only slight caveat, Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, is we're also trying to make sure that if that lender has like a subsidiary or some sort of successor, that they just kicked it over to there, that it would apply. But if it's some other institution that wasn't involved in the transaction at all, and they've purchased it not knowing the situation, that it would not apply to them.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. I'm sorry that I have to play catch-up.
Does this have a wisdom or something?
Okay. Any further questions for these witnesses? Representative Edwards.
Mr. Chair, I don't have any questions. I mean, I thank Representative Clem and Mr. Cummins and Mr. Martinez for working together on this. It is my constituent is the one that's in question at the root of all of this that kind of brought it to the forefront. And I will save my further my comments about how despicable everything has been up to this point, the behavior of one particular lender, for the floor.
Okay. So. Thank you.
I would like to say one more thing, if I could.
Yes, you may.
Since Representative Edwards made that comment about the lender, it's First Franklin out of Pittsburgh, and First Franklin was an arm, subprime arm of Merrill Lynch. And in March of 2008, Merrill Lynch, knowing it was going down basically at that point or seeing signs, cut that group loose so they just became a collection agency and couldn't write new loans. It's my understanding. That's off the internet. And then, of course, we all know that Merrill Lynch folded their tent. So basically, this First Franklin is sitting out there as nothing more than a collection agency waiting to file all of these lawsuits. And it isn't just Oregon that's affected. In California and Arizona, this law is already in effect as we propose. And so they will not be pursuing people down there. But they weren't writing that many there. The loophole was in Oregon, and that's where the loans were written. And as Representative Clem pointed out, there's two cases, a federal case, which is in my written materials, and the State of Oregon case that points to this loophole but says we're the courts, we can't legislate. The legislature needs to fill this hole, and that's what we're doing today. Thank you.
Thank you. We also have Chris Schultz and Drew Hagedorn to speak on the 11s. The 12s, I think.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, I'm Chris Schultz representing Guerrilla Capital. Guerrilla Capital is the largest purchaser of foreclosed homes in Oregon. The A-12s are an unrelated amendment.
You want to make sure you identify yourself and right into the microphone.
Sorry.
You can pull it closer to you.
Sure. I'm Chris Schultz, okay, representing Guerrilla Capital, the largest purchaser of foreclosure homes in the state of Oregon. The A-12s are an unrelated set of amendments to Representative Clem's bill. House Bill 3004 has an appropriate relating clause. The A-12 amendments are a compromise between Guerrilla Capital and the United Trustees, represented by Mr. Hagedorn. Policy in the A-12s has been discussed extensively in Representative Holvey's committee and in Senator Bonamici's committee. Representative Holvey's office also sent the amendments around to interested parties to make sure there were no unintended consequences. The background of this issue, if I could take just a moment, is this deals with a situation where the foreclosure auction is stayed by a bankruptcy filing. In these situations, when the property is freed from the automatic stay, the trustee resumes the foreclosure sale and sets a new date for the auction. They give a 20-day notice to the homeowner and a 20-day notice to the lender, and they're required by law to give a 20-day notice to anybody who showed up on the courthouse steps and was interested in that auction. What happens in practice is process servers collect business cards on the courthouse steps. Those names and addresses often don't get back to the trustee in the experience of Guerrilla Capital, and they're not notified when the home comes back on the market and is available for purchase at a foreclosure auction. The only way to get notice is to get a copy of the amended notice of sale. The meat of these amendments is on page 3 of the A-12 amendments. What they provide is that the trustee can post the amended notice of sale on a website, or if they don't have a website, a prospective purchaser such as Guerrilla Capital could request that they receive a copy of that via certified mail. There's a strong policy rationale for a change such as this. Having multiple bidders on these foreclosure homes drives up the price, and any amount over the debt goes in the homeowner's pocket. So we think it will increase the number of bidders on these foreclosed homes and possibly put more money in the pockets of Oregonians who are unfortunately losing their homes. The trustees and the purchasers consider this an improvement. As best we know, there are no negative consequences, and we encourage your support.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Drew Hagedorn for the United Trustees Association. We're in support of the Dash A-12s to House Bill 3004. As Mr. Schultz indicated, we work with Guerrilla Capital on this issue. We view the Dash 12s as a more thorough and efficient means by which to notify those required under statute of an amended notice of sale, so we urge your support. Thank you.
Any questions for these two witnesses? Okay. Thank you both. Is there anyone else here who would like to speak to House Bill 3004? Seeing none, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3004. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3004 for the purpose of putting in these two amendments, if we so fee, that we don't have the physical or the res right now, so we will come back to that later if, in fact, they come in today. But we will go with the amendment, so I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 11s, one set at a time?
Yeah.
One set, okay, I move the Dash 11s dated 5-2009 into House Bill 3004A.
Representative Edwards moves to adopt the Dash 11 amendments dated May 20th, 2009 to House Bill 3004A. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash A-12 amendments into House Bill 3004A.
Representative Edwards moves that we adopt the Dash 12 amendments to House Bill dated May 26, 2009. To House Bill 3004A, is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. We will leave this work session open in case we were to get either of those later for today. And then, so remind me, I have to close this later. And now, let's see if I have other people here who I need.
Well, if you're going from the top, you can start with the you need to be disordered, of course. You need to be closed. You need to be closed. 2084, that's the Secretary of State.
So we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2084. I'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Roblin. House Bill 2084 changes ORS 79.0515 by deleting existing provision that requires the Secretary of State to send renewal notices concerning financing statements or effective financing statements for secured transactions or agricultural liens that are filed with the Secretary. There is a Dash 1 amendment that permits the Secretary of State to provide renewal notice report to a secured party electronically upon request and specifies the content of the report. Financing statements are used to provide notice of a creditor's interest in personal property, including fixtures, and to establish the priority of creditor interest in such property. Oregon law, ORS Chapter 79, currently provides that the Secretary of State must send a renewal notice not less than 3 months or more than 6 months before the expiration of any financing statement, notifying the secured party or assignee of record that the financing statement may be continued by filing a continuation statement or initial financing statement prior to expiration. The effect of a filing statement lapses on the expiration of the period. The effectiveness of a filing statement lapses on the expiration of the period of its effectiveness, either 5 years or 30 years, unless it is continued. Lapse has a significant impact upon the rights of a creditor or assignee of a creditor. Upon lapse, a financing statement ceases to be effective and any security interest that was perfected solely by the financing statement becomes unperfected. Furthermore, an unperfected security interest is deemed never have been perfected as against a purchaser of the collateral for value. Proponents assert that the requirement for the state to provide a renewal notice is an exception to the UCC Model Act adopted by every other state. Proponents further assert that technology has evolved to the point that secured parties can and should be responsible for managing their own financing statement expiration dates, that the mailing of renewal notices creates expense to the government, and that secured parties frequently complain that receiving renewal notices creates unnecessary work for their staff.
So with that, we will have Peter Thornkel, I hope I got that right, and Tim Martinez. Is it Tim? From the OBA, is Tim here? Don't see him right now, so we'll go with this. He was here.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Peter Threlkill. I'm the director of the Corporation Division for the Secretary of State's office, here to speak with you about House Bill 2084. The division first proposed this bill as a measure to respond to complaints from some of our constituents in the secured party creditor industry to recognize practices of the rest of the country and to save some money for the state. As we got into the bill, the Oregon Bar Association debtor-creditor section and the Oregon Bankers Association both expressed a strong interest in retaining the renewal notice that the division sends out. We did go back and work with the stakeholder groups, and we have the Dash 1 amendments that are before you today. We believe that this is a much better solution. It actually addresses the concerns of the secured parties who do not want to receive the notices, as well as those who do. It provides the Secretary a way to save some money through the elimination of postage expense, and it we actually had some of the stakeholders ask if they could start receiving the email reports today and not wait for the new law to possibly pass and go into effect. One of the things that that we provide today is on a postcard, and it just lists the file number, the expiration date, and the name of the debtor. With the new system, we're able to email out an Excel spreadsheet that shows every lien that's going to expire between, I believe it's 90 days and 360 days out. And so for banks and creditors, this is a much more workable solution. It really lets them plan their work for the coming months and year. They know which of their clients they need to go contact, which of the liens that they want to renew. It provides information about additional filings. If they've already terminated a lien, that'll show up on the report. So it actually provides them a lot better information. It's more useful. And we have a pretty general agreement that this would be a good process for the debtor and creditor community. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
So it is the Dash Ones that ensure the electronic notification.
And, Dash Ones, yes.
We believe there is concurrence amongst the groups that were a little uptight about it before.
That is what they informed.
Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm showing my ignorance here, but could you give me the definition of unperfected and perfected security?
Chair Roblin, Representative Gerard. The process of perfecting is basically filing the public notice with the Secretary of State's office. So when you may have a promissory note and a security agreement with someone that owes you money, a debtor, you perfect that and secure your position as a secured creditor by making the filing with our office. Then in the event that a debtor goes bankrupt, you're able to go to the bankruptcy court and show that you're the first secured creditor in line or the fifth secured creditor in line based on who got to our office first.
Thank you.
Any further questions of this witness? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to close our public hearing on 2084. And I'm going to open a work session on 2084. We do have all the paperwork on this one. It's all there. Yeah.
Mr. Chair.
First, the amendment, yeah.
I move the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2084.
Representative Berger moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2084. They were dated 5609. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Speaker, I move House Bill 2084 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Berger moves House Bill 2084 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, we'll have a roll call vote.
Representative Girard?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
Excused.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Excused.
Chair Roland?
Aye. The motion passes. Is there anyone who would like to carry this bill to the floor? I will carry the bill. I love carrying bills. It keeps me from the other place.
We're not.
And this is one of those housekeeping bills. I understand that one. Okay. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2853. We'll have a short explanation and.
Did you open a work session or a public hearing?
Public hearing, right now.
Members of the committee, House Bill 2853 expands the prohibition on possessing and transferring firearms to include persons found guilty of misdemeanors except for insanity. There are a number of amendments, but I believe only the Dash 5 is under consideration. It incorporates provisions of some of the previous amendments with some legal refinements, corresponding technical adjustment and reordered sections, replaces references to determination of a person's qualifications vis-a-vis firearms throughout with mere identification of such persons and the transmission and maintenance of their information in conformity with federal requirements, includes the record of persons relieved from prohibitions regarding firearms. Makes more specific and explicit the nature of the information to be provided, clarifies and corrects processes to obtain relief and appellate review, allows the petition for relief every 2 years, places a definition of federal firearms disability, or replaces the definition of federal firearms disability with state mental health determination for consistency and includes within the same determinations made by the Psychiatric Security Review Board, clarifies the prospective effect and effective dates.
And with that, Bob, thanks for being here.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is David Yendell. I'm the director of the Law Enforcement Information Division for the Oregon State Police. As you may recall, two weeks ago we introduced this bill. It is essentially a gut and stuff of House Bill 2853. The primary purpose of the bill is to bring Oregon into compliance with the National Instant Criminal Background Check System Improvement Amendments Act of 2007, which became federal law in January of 2008. I may have mentioned in our first presentation that we discovered late last year that the state of Oregon has a total of 4 records in the National Instant Criminal Check System Index database. That's one of the primary purposes of this bill, is to assist us in adopting the corrected language in Oregon law that's consistent with federal law and allows the Department of State Police to begin the process of working with state agencies to attain the state's compliance with the Act. I'm prepared to give you a very basic overview of each section. There's 15 sections of the Dash 5 amendments. I might mention that since the bill was scheduled last week, and I understand that you pulled it from the schedule, additional discussions have occurred with the National Rifle Association, with the Oregon Disability Rights folks. We've done our best, we feel, to try to address the immediate concerns that a number of the constituent groups have brought to our attention. I understand that they may have a couple of technical questions that they would like to address before you today, and we've asked Josh Nasby with Legislative Counsel's Office, and we have Herb Lovejoy from the Department of Justice, who's been our legal counsel, here to assist in answering any specific questions the committee members may have or that you have of any of us in dealing with the Dash 5 amendments. With that, Mr. Chair, be glad to accommodate your wishes.
I want to thank you for the work you have been doing, because I know they've been working very hard to get here, and for our drafters for going through the stuff they haven't. I guess what I think we might do now is invite these other groups up to see what, hear from them, and then come back with you guys at the end if we need any questions to clarify. So with that, I will. Oh wait, question? Yes.
Can I ask a question?
Sure.
Quickly, and just in looking at the amendment, I had thought that I had understood from discussions that I'd had with Joe O'Leary that language that would have scooped up people who were unable to provide for their own personal needs had been removed. But in the bill, it still include in the Dash 5 amendment, lines 10 through 12, it still includes have been committed by a court to the Department of Human Services or adjudicated by a court as mentally retarded under ORS 427-290. And if I go there, it says, after hearing all of the evidence and reviewing the findings of the investigation and other examiners, the court shall determine whether the person is mentally retarded and because of mental retardation is either dangerous to self or others or is unable to provide for the personal needs of the person. So it seems like that issue has not been addressed and pulled out. It's still referenced.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gelser, the conversations that we had this morning was to specifically address the civil commitment concerns that we understood you had, and specifically to make clear that it's in those instances where the individual is determined to be a danger to themselves or others, or the court prohibits their access to or receiving a firearm. Those would be the only two civil commitment processes that we would be specifically focused on under that section. And we have draft language prepared to actually make that change in a subsequent amendment.
So it's not you're not proffering that it's offered in this amendment here. That's you recognize that that's still missing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Belzer, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
So with that, we'll decide. We got it. Just so people know where it's at a little bit. I got a note from the Speaker to send it to Ways and Means so they could do a couple of these little things and get it on its way to the next step. It has a, if you look at it, the amount of money that it costs, most of it will come from grants, and we understand that that's other funds, but it makes it concern. So we can decide if we want to keep it here for the last minute before we send it or send it there today. Yes, Representative Gelser.
And Mr. Chair, I would have significant concern sending this forward without that language because I do believe it would eliminate a basic constitutional right from someone on the basis that they have mental retardation.
So with that, Kevin Sterrett, Rod Harder, and Bob Junda.
Members of the committee, for the record, Kevin Sterrett, Oregon Firearms Federation. In the past, I've discussed with you what our philosophical problems are with the bill, and those haven't changed, but I have some real concerns, echoing Representative Gelser's, that language about mental retardation is still in there, but there's some other language in here. We got these amendments 30 seconds ago. There's 32 pages of them. Mr. Yandell did email them to me earlier today as I was walking into another hearing. It's almost impossible to analyze this much stuff, but I did notice that if you look at page 10 of the bill, it amends, and this might be a misunderstanding on my part, I'd be happy to be corrected, but page 10 amends 166-274. Page 20 amends 166-274. And on page 10, it seems to take out what page 20 puts in, and on 20, it does the opposite. So I think there may be some drafting issues here, unless I'm just completely getting it wrong. But the other thing I want to point out to you is that depending on which page is going to be the operative page, 166.274 either is, you have this existing language is shown in bold as though it's new, but it is exactly the language that's in the bill. But there's a problem with that language, and you need to know about that. If you look at line 23 on page 20, 23 and 24, it refers to a person who's barred from possessing under 166.251 small c, A, B, D, and E. And C is left out. That is current law. C is left out. That is an error in Oregon law that is going to be hopefully corrected in a Senate bill that should have been dealt with in the House Judiciary Committee today, but apparently is being held hostage by somebody. So that is going to be a problem no matter how you draft this. And my basic concern, in addition to Representative Gelser's, my problem with the philosophical aspect of this is one thing, but 32 pages of changes that we haven't really had a chance to analyze, it could have a profound effect on how gun rights are administered, would be a pretty dangerous thing to move along. I think you, Mr. Chairman, yourself commented last time that you'd prefer to do it right than do it quickly.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rod Harder, the Oregon consultant for the National Rifle Association. I don't like this bill, in case anyone doesn't know that. And Representative Gelser, our concerns, as I said last time I testified, are in writing. We have expressed those to the folks in the state police. However, I think there has been some significant movement on this bill since the last time we met. For one thing, and I'm going to try to explain a little bit about our participation in it. One of the things that we objected to originally was the state police making a determination on somebody's mental qualifications to be prohibited from owning a firearm. We have changed that. That prohibition now is going to be made by the people closest to the case, and that would be the three agencies that are involved. They're the ones that are next to it. They're the ones that are best able to determine what those qualifications are medically and psychiatrically. After that, the OSP now will just forward the information, which is indeed minimal this time, not like it was in the last draft. It is name, gender, a couple of other things, and then a number, a case number from one of the agencies so that can be identified. So they will now be sending the information on and not have any access to the records whatsoever. We have also in the bill taken out that portion of the law that was put in the original concealed handgun license bill that gave state police direct access to mental records. That has gone away. I had hoped that when we adjudicated the mental retardation portion of the law that we would have included people who were considered disabled by the court and not able to watch out for themselves. That does, in fact, not appear, and that does have to that has to take place because for reasons we all know. We broadened the ability for people to appeal a prohibition, and now that can take place every 2 years rather than every 5 years that was in the original bill. That's a good step forward also. But more importantly, I think on that, without previously, the state police could object to or not even honor a a determination by the psychiatric review board that the person had been relieved of the prohibition. That's gone away also. In cases where the person has been prohibited, they can appeal, and they can take it through the court system where that was very limited previously. So that's another step I think we've really gained some ground on. Finally, with regards to appeal, the state is no longer able to appeal if the person is found not to be prohibited. Previously, we could have held that person up. The state could have gone to court repeatedly. And now the only person that can appeal to a higher court is the person who has been relieved or not. there are a number of things we obviously have missed, and with 31 pages, I've had the bill for a couple of days, and even that, I will guarantee you there's some things in there I don't know about. With regard to what Mr. Sterrett said, he's speaking about a portion of the law that says a felon, after 15 years, can petition the court and be able to purchase a firearm. However, paragraph C that has not been included in the law says he can't possess it. So he can go buy one, but he could be charged with misdemeanor possession if he has it. So that's what that would correct, and it's Senate Bill 603 that is currently in the House Judiciary Committee that fixes that as part of another bill. And so those two things are going to have to be reconciled one way or the other. But we would like to see it fixed either in this bill or these two bills made to be similar with that regard. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. I probably don't know enough any now about anything else to answer.
Mr. Chairman, if I might,
yes.
Mr. Harder correctly pointed out that a person may purchase but not own a firearm, but this particular section doesn't deal with that problem. This particular section deals with another problem that says people can request permission to petition for relief under A, B, D, or E. They may not petition for relief under C, and what C is that you've committed a felony as an adult. So that's the only classification of people who can't petition for relief. We don't think that was intended. The 15-year rule is an entirely different problem that we're hoping will be addressed in 603.
Okay. Mr. Junev.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Junev. I'm from Disability Rights Oregon, and I'd like to thank Mr. Yandell and Mr. O'Leary for working with us to try to resolve some of the concerns that we've had about House Bill 2853. I just very quickly want to go over what our concerns are and what our understanding is at this point. Is that number one is that we're trying through this bill to match state law and federal law, and they don't match so well together in certain ways. So, for example, in state law, there are prohibitions about firearm ownership and possession, but those are different than the ones under federal law. And yet, what we're dealing with is a bill that asks that information be sent off to the federal government that can have the effect of triggering, if you will, the federal law, even though it wouldn't be a prohibition under the state law. And one of those areas has to do with commitment of people for quote-unquote mental retardation in our state and commitment in people who have been found mentally ill by a court but not committed to the hospital because they've been deemed by a judge to be able to return to the community. And within those groups, there are people who have not been found dangerous by the court but have been found not to be able to provide for their own basic needs because of their disabling condition. And so we had some concerns about those areas, and those are ones that I understand are going to be addressed in some subsequent amendments, but I just wanted to alert you to that. The others have to do with what we consider to be just basic fairness in this process, and those have to do, number one, with notice, that is that people who are entering into these processes have some notification up front about what the consequences may be of choosing to use an insanity defense of entering into a commitment process. There's a diversion process in the commitment process that people can choose or not choose, and so having this information is important in making a decision. The second is expungement. The federal law specifically notes that folks should have an opportunity to expunge commitments. We had another bill that in this session that would have allowed that, but it didn't make it out of its committee. So that's another area we had concerns about. The last one, which I actually didn't talk about with Mr. Yandell because I hadn't gone through the entire draft either, is just another oddity that's an effect of our present funding problem, is that Section 5 is the section of the bill that provides for a process through the PSRB for being relieved of having to report the disabling condition, if you will. The way it's structured, it says that the PSRB doesn't have to provide these hearings right away. It only has to provide those hearings once it has the funding to do so,
and that it has written a rule indicating that it has the funds and it's ready to do it. And then there's a sunset on that requirement for them. There's a similar provision in all the areas for all the agencies that have to report. I don't know how this is going to roll out, but I can imagine the situation in which money goes to one place and not another, and you end up with people being reported but not having that hearing available to them because the money hasn't gotten there and the rule hasn't been enacted by the PSRB to initiate the hearing, make the hearings available to people. I don't know how that's going to work, but my sense is that in the implementation of this bill, there would have to be some ongoing work to make sure that there was some consistency there. It's not required right now in the bill. Mr. O'Leary, Mr. Yandell have indicated willingness to work with us on particularly the expungement issue and the notice issue so that we can put together some legislation for next session, which is a comfort to us and gives us enough comfort that we're neutral on the bill. And on the Section 5 issue in terms of when it's funded, we hope to continue to monitor that because we're hoping that that all rolls out at the same time and that folks who do all of a sudden have their name in a federal registry will have an opportunity to have a hearing to have it removed if it's appropriate.
Okay. Thank you very much. Any questions for this panel? Okay. Thank you. I'm going to call back up Mr. Yandell, and we have our drafter and here as well. Yep. Thanks. And, yeah, everybody can come on.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, David Yandell, Oregon State Police again. And to my left, your right, is Herb Lovejoy, our Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Justice. And to my right, your left, is Josh Nasby from the Legislative Council's office.
So I guess what I'd ask is, you heard the testimony. Are these draftable issues that can be taken care of in a fairly short period of time? So if we're looking at bringing this back on Friday, could we have those, or would it be better to say Monday? Because we have members here who I don't think are comfortable moving this bill until a few other things happen. So I can ask that to any and all of you.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, Joshua Nasby for the record. I'd be happy to draft an amendment by Friday if that's what you'd like.
Representative Kelser.
Would it be helpful if I was clear about what would help me?
That would probably be helpful.
It would help me if it was clear that the only information that went into a database regarding a person that had a developmental disability, mental retardation, or a mental illness was a person that had been found guilty except for insanity, or a person who had been accused of a crime and unable, therefore, to aid and assist. So only a person who, not somebody, thought that they might do something someday later that might make them a danger to themselves or others, but a person that is accused of committing an actual crime,
now,
criminal activity.
The question that I would have there is sometimes there is no finding that they committed a crime because they aren't capable of committing the crime. So if it, you know what I'm saying?
And that's why I said if there is a crime that has been committed,
okay,
they are being prosecuted for that crime. They go to aid and assist. They're found unable to aid and assist. So there has been a suspicion of a criminal action, but not we've met this person, they've made threats, or we've appraised their behavior or their disability, and we assume a person with this disability might be a danger to themselves or might be a danger to others. That the trigger is this person needs to actively have done something that has caused damage to another person, not just by virtue that they are a person with a mental illness or a developmental disability. They have to actually have committed some sort of a crime.
Chair Roblin, Representative Gelser, my name is Herbert Lovejoy. I'm a senior assistant attorney with the Oregon Department of Justice. I'm here in my representative capacity as general counsel for the Oregon State Police. Representative Gelser, I understand your concern. The one thing that I think the committee needs to understand is that under federal law, it is not just when a person commits a crime that will constitute a federal firearm disability under federal law. Since 1968, when Congress enacted the Gun Control Act, they have determined that certain individuals should not possess a firearm. One of those individual classes are individuals that the federal law determines to be mental defective, their words, or individuals who are formally involuntarily committed to a mental institution. Under federal law, the definition of mental defective includes individuals who are, by a formal adjudication by a court, board, state, or commission on the state side, are determined to be a danger to themselves or others, or who are incapable of contracting or managing their own affairs. So under federal law, what happens is automatic by operation of federal law. If there is that kind of adjudication, those individuals are automatically prohibited from possessing a firearm under federal law. And it's that, so it's not just whether or not a person has committed a crime. It's also that formal adjudication that constitutes what federal law determines to be mental defective.
Mr. Chair, may I? I appreciate that. I understand that from, and I really appreciate Mr. O'Leary, who spent a fair amount of time talking about this with me in my office. I understand that that's what the federal law says. I also understand that that we had misunderstood how few states were participating in this, that we're not one of, you know, three or four or five, we're one of 18. I, recognizing that the federal law is different, I don't get to have a vote on federal law. I get to have a vote on state law. And I am comfortable expanding what we put into that system to the places where somebody has committed a crime. I cannot vote in favor of something that strips away the basic constitutional right of a person based on a disability. I just can't. Even if that's what the federal law is, I can't. So maybe that's not an amendment you can bring forward, and that's fine. The bill can move without my yes vote, and I'll just be a no. But that's what I would need to be able to be comfortable with the bill.
Okay. Thanks. Any other questions of this group? And I tend to agree exactly with what Representative Elser has said, is I think what our goal is to try to get some compliance with this law. I don't know that it has to go as far as Representative Gelser needs to go. I can go someplace else if that's where we really think it needs to be. But we also need to make sure that we will have the votes here to make that happen. So, but it's not quite ready from what I'm hearing from people, but it's fairly close. So I guess what I will tell you is that we'll reschedule this bill for Friday, but I appreciate the work, because I do think it's come a long, long ways from where we started, and it's actually starting to lose some of those things. And I understand the purpose of this bill was to try to help give the tools necessary that if we think someone is a danger, it doesn't mean that they've actually done the crime in some ways. It came out of the Virginia Tech shootings. And a lot of people were very upset that we had a young man, even though this bill would not have affected that necessarily, a young man who a lot of people have acknowledged had a problem, but there was no controls on that problem. And it is one that I think, in as we look around to protect ourselves, we have that fine balance between individual rights and protection of society. And that's why it's so hard to come up with the bill. So I appreciate the work, and hopefully we're going to have a bill. Any other conversations or questions? Thank you very much. And we're going to close our public hearing on House Bill 2853. And with that, okay. Is that a work session only?
I've never watched a meeting between the representative and ledge counsel on the record, right? And no, that was like a meeting with legislative counsel. Would normally happen.
Well, we'd have to
in the privacy of legislative council.
What happened right here?
Let's go to the first one. We're going to open a public hearing, a work session on 3401, the per site account offset. We'll have a short explanation by our administrator.
Thank you, Chair Robin, members of the committee. House Bill 3401
allows a public employer participating in the public employee's retirement system to request that excess amounts on a side account established for lump sum payments either be refunded to the employer or applied to offset contributions to an individual account program if the public employee's retirement board determines that amounts in the account exceed amounts necessary to fund the employer's actuarial liabilities. Declares an emergency effective on passage. The Dash 2 amendments, which are not presently before you, but have been before you before, eliminates the option in the original measure for public employer to request that excess amounts in the account be refunded to the employer, directs the public employer's retirement board to offset contributions only if the board determines that applying excess amounts does not cause loss of qualification as a qualified government retirement plan and trust under the Internal Revenue Code or regulations adopted pursuant thereto, requires the public employee's retirement board to seek a ruling from the Internal Revenue Service on whether the application of excess amounts would cause such a loss. The amendment that you have in your packet, the Dash 3 amendments combines Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments, and I think that's all I need to tell you about it.
Okay. And we have not accepted any of the amendments yet.
On this one, no.
Okay. Is moved.
You have it as moved?
I have it as moved in the minutes.
Check and make sure. Okay. So, work session. This is the bill that, as we had the explanation, shared with us that these PERS accounts grew larger than their unfunded mandate, in some cases extremely large. And the goal of the Amendment 3 was to allow them to be able to offset their PERS expenses when those discrepancies were high enough and actually use that excess money to pay down their PERS share in those other years. Is there any?
Dash 3 was moved.
And the Dash 3 is amended. Okay, very good. So is there any discussion or with regard to this bill? I will entertain a motion then.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Berger.
This goes to the floor.
Yep. Oh, did we get?
No.
Did we get a subsequent referral on this one?
We have a letter for giving us subsequent referral.
Did it have a physical that was pretty high?
Had an indeterminate physical.
This one had an indeterminate physical. And
where do you want it to go?
And we do have a letter allowing us to.
So we can send it if we would like.
To the floor.
To the floor or to the Ways and Means.
What do you want to do?
Let me call up some of the PERS people that were here before. Okay, come up for a second.
You have the statement in your packet.
Mr. Chair, Lori Satinspiel for the Oregon School Boards. I'm just accompanying the PERS people.
Okay.
Chair Roblin, my name is Susan Riswick with PERS.
Thank you. And we got an indeterminate fiscal back. I don't know if you saw it.
I know of the fiscal that we sent to LFO. I've not seen what LFO has sent to you.
Okay. And did your have an expense that would come from general fund?
Not from general fund,
but
or another fund agency.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. So yeah. It's an other fund issue. Every time I get these, I keep wondering whether I should have it go to Ways and Means and then just look at it or not. Do you have a preference with regard to this? Do you think this is one of those that, from your perspective, even though this is all other funds, should be looked at with respect to Ways and Means?
Well, the information that we sent in, the fiscal information, noted that there were two fiscal pieces. One dealt with $50,000 for the cost to do a private letter ruling, and the other was $125,000 to do some system modifications based on if there was going to be a favorable ruling from the IRS that we could proceed in this manner. So,
okay. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The other funds, what are the source of the other funds?
That's right. Let's see. That I would have to get back to you on.
If I may.
Yes.
One of the concerns that I always have in the when I'm looking at other funds in the budget is oftentimes those other funds originate as general funds. They are the general fund appropriation to an agency or an entity who then pay those something out to another source, and the other source records them as other funds. I would be interested in knowing where those funds what they were when they originated.
Representative Jensen, Chair Roblin, I'd be happy to get back that information to you.
Should we just send away some answers? Okay. Thank you. I think we have made our decision. We're gonna send it to Ways and Means.
Okay.
So I think we're okay with that one. So, and we have a letter that says we can. Pardon?
Do pass.
Okay. Yeah.
You want a motion, Mr. Chair?
Yes. Representative Berger.
I move House Bill 3401 to the floor with a do pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Berger moves House Bill 3401 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Question.
Yes.
Is that
discussion.
As amended?
As amended.
It's already
with
been
dash.
Thank you. With
it's already
dash
been
reasons.
Amended. Yes, as
okay.
amended.
As amended. So I'll go back and repeat that. We're going to move, Representative Berger moves House Bill 3401 as amended to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Discussion.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair. If they would be kind enough maybe to have that information for the committee that it goes to,
okay.
It might be helpful in
and, get it,
okay. and expedited.
Thank you very much. Any other discussion? Seeing none, we'll take a roll call vote.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. Representative Nolan?
Excuse.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Roblin?
Aye. Motion passes, and we'll send it off. We don't need to have a... So we're going to close the work session on Senate House Bill 3401. We're going to open a work session on 3490. We'll have a short explanation by our administrator. And again, this is just the work session. Oh, good.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. House Bill 3490 modifies theft in the first degree to include theft of agricultural property valued at $100 or more and committed on property granting farm use special assessment under certain additional circumstances. This measure has been before your committee before.
So 3490, do we have any amendments?
We have no amendments to 3490. We do have a fiscal, which is an indeterminate fiscal, which should be in your packet.
No, I don't have it.
It's not
indeterminate.
Correct.
Not in
it has a fiscal.
Yes.
Yep.
Okay.
Do we have a subsequent referral letter?
We have a letter allowing us to subsequently refer this, if we wish, to the Ways and Means Committee.
And again, I saw this fiscal, and I thought we probably should just send it to the floor. So, with that, I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Berger.
If I could comment on the motion. This is a good bill. It addresses an issue that we do need to address. It does have a fiscal on it. Therefore, I move House Bill 3490 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Berger moves House Bill 3490 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, we'll have a roll call vote. It is a good one.
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
Excused.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Rowland?
Aye.
Passes, and we'll send it off to Ways and Means. We're going to close our work session on House Bill 3490. We're going to open a public hearing on this one.
Yeah.
Senate Bill 326. With that, we'll have a short explanation, and we'll invite our senators forward, and I appreciate them having me. Pardon?
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. Senate Bill 326 allows a voter to participate in more than one nominating process for each partisan public office to be filled at the general election. Background on this is that House Bill 2614 in 2005 was passed to resolve statutory ambiguity in situations where a voter participates in a minor and major party nominating process. The statutory prohibition against the voter participating in one or more nominating process for each partisan office follows the principle of one person, one vote, as identified in U.S. Supreme Court decision Reynolds versus Sims. ORS 254.069 prohibits a voter from participating in the primary election for a major political party and participating in the designated nominating process for an affiliated or minor political party candidate. The voter cannot return a primary election ballot and also participate in the nominating process for a minor party candidate, as defined in ORS 248.009, by signing the minutes of a minor party convention or by signing a certificate of nomination. Administrative rules have been promulgated by the Secretary of State pursuant to House Bill 2614, determined that the return of a primary ballot is the voter's primary act of participating in a primary election. If a filing officer determines during the certification process beginning 15 days after the primary election that a voter has participated in more than one nominating process, the signature cannot be counted towards satisfying the party's nomination requirement. The administrative rule is specified in your SMS. The signature is invalidated without consideration of when such nominating act occurred or if the voter had completed his or her primary ballot for the office in question. Senate Bill 326 would repeal the 2005 measure and allow a voter to participate in the nomination process for a minor party candidate and cast a primary election ballot.
And with that, the two senators, I'll let you decide. I don't want to be the one to
I'll go ahead and start and defer to my good colleague, Senator Walker. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Rick Metzger, State Senator, District 26. And thank you for hearing House Bill 3326. It is the shortest bill in this legislative session. It contains only two words, as a ORS designation, followed by the words, is repealed. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, sometimes we do things that we think are great ideas, and then we find out the unintended consequences of the bill. I'll use an example. As chair of the Transportation Committee, we thought it was a great idea to have 20-mile-per-hour speed zones in schools. It just sounded good. It didn't work out. And when that happens, he has the responsibility of the legislature to correct that and to acknowledge that. House Bill 2614, passed in 2005, as your committee administrator mentioned, was designed to address an issue that was a concern at that time of someone trying to qualify for the 2004 general election. Actually didn't work. That individual for president did not qualify anyway. What happened was the unintended consequences of is over 430,000 Oregonians who consider themselves unaffiliated now for all intents and purposes cannot run for any partisan office and cannot sign a petition effectively nominating anyone who is an unaffiliated voter. You may have remember now Treasurer Westland attempted this and after spending over $100,000 had to abandon that effort. Former Governor Kitzhaber considered doing this and it was unavailable realistically to meet that accomplishment. This 2614 also, as legislative counsel, and I just recently talked with them again about this, this has been only on the books for a while, so it has not officially been challenged, but also raises, as counsel would tell you, serious constitutional issues. It says that if you return a ballot, and a ballot usually contains multiple elections, 20, maybe 30 elections, Secretary of State, your state senator, whatever, that if you return that, even though you may have only voted for your school bond issue, you are assumed to have participated in every election on that ballot, and therefore unable to nominate by petition anyone else to run for the general election. It is strictly undemocratic. Under House Bill 2614, a person must, if they want their vote for a minor or unaffiliated candidate be counted towards their nomination, give up the right to vote for any partisan or nonpartisan office in a primary election, give up the right to vote on any and all measures on the primary election ballot, including all initiatives, referrals, and tax measures. It's simply unequal treatment and discrimination at the ballot box. Senate Bill 326 repeals 2614, eliminating unfair and undemocratic statutes that has disenfranchised unaffiliated candidates, political parties, and voters who want to have a voice in the political dialogue in Oregon. It was very fascinating in your Senate Rules Committee, where a number of folks on that committee had voted in favor of this in 2005, were very passionate about the mistake they had made. We passed this unanimously out of Senate Rules and unanimously on the floor of the Oregon Senate, restoring the democratic right of people to participate in this process. Ironically, and I think you'll hear testimony from one gentleman, and I appreciate the great work he has done in what is now, quote, the Independent Party, it actually had another consequence that I think the proponents did not anticipate. It rose to the creation of a, quote, Independent Party as people trying to find a way to access. And now it's been very confusing, as you know. People don't think they're a member of a party, and they're signing up the Independent Party. And I understand that reasoning. But those numbers are growing, and without much time, it's very likely the Independent Party will become a major party and will have a candidate on every ballot, which is the exact opposite of what the proponents had originally intended. In the meantime, 430,000 Oregonians basically have no access to run for office or support. This is good democratic legislation. It supports the right of everyone to participate. It takes away the constitutional cloud and says that our process is open to everyone. And with that, Mr. Chair, I would like to defer to my good colleague.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Vicki Walker, State Senator, District 7. And I should have listened to my tummy in 2005. And I didn't, and I've regretted it ever since. And having had the opportunity to run for statewide office, you hear from a lot of folks around the state of Oregon, and this issue came up many times in my tour around the state. We have a lot of independent-minded voters in Oregon. They don't fit into the two classic political parties. In fact, my son withdrew from the Democratic Party of Oregon after the last election and joined, I think, the Pacific Green Party. I'm not sure which, but one of the minor parties because he was unhappy with the results of the major parties. So if you get yourself into a political party, great. If you're non-affiliated, that's great too, but we have essentially shut off their opportunity to nominate someone of their own choosing, because if you cast your ballot in the primary like I do in every single election, then I don't have the right to sign a petition to allow someone free access to the ballot. I think that's wrong. I think it disenfranchises voters, as my colleague has indicated, and it isn't really what I had in mind when I voted for this bill in 2005. It is one of the few votes that I regret, and fortunately I was here long enough that I could rectify my mistake, and that's why I've worked very hard with Senator Metzger to bring this bill before you today and make sure that Oregon restores the right to choose and the right to vote to every Oregonian.
Any questions for this panel?
You know, I always look favorably on a bill that actually repeals a statute. We don't get many chances to do that in this process. One last thing on the books.
It's kind of fun and exhilarating, isn't it, Mr. Chair?
Thank you.
Madam Vice Chair.
Representative Edwards, did you?
No.
Okay. Well, thank you both.
All right, thank you.
And Sal Peralta.
Been a few days,
Chair Roble and members of the committee. I'm here today to testify on behalf of the Independent Party of Oregon in favor of Senate Bill 326. You are fortunate in that my computer crashed on the way into this meeting, so I don't have my prepared remarks, but I would just like to echo what the two senators who preceded me said. I think that your committee has the opportunity to ensure, once again, that every voter in this state can participate fully in the state's election process, both running as a candidate and supporting the nomination of a non-affiliated candidate. It's worth mentioning that non-affiliated candidates possess none of the same infrastructure that is available to candidates who run as a member of the party. It is much harder to get access to the ballot. It is much harder to raise money. And I would just encourage the committee to repeal this measure that essentially piles on to candidates who are already at a significant disadvantage. And with that, I'll be glad to answer any questions you may have.
Any questions for Sal? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We're going to close our public hearing on Senate Bill 326. And now we're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2867. And with that, we'll have a short explanation. And we'll invite Ms. Unger to come up.
Thank you, Chair Roblin, members of the committee. House Bill 2867 has been before you several times. The basic bill requires contracting agencies before entering into a public contract to establish measurable standards to assess the quality of a contractor's performance and clear consequences for failing to meet those standards. A number of amendments have been out there. You have two in your packet, the Dash 5 amendments, which replaces the original measure. Among its provisions, it excludes cities or counties that have a population of not more than 15,000, community colleges that enroll no more than 1,000 full-time equivalent students, and special districts in coverage of the measure, and increases the coverage threshold from $25,000 to $150,000, and makes a number of other changes to the original measure. The Dash 5 was previously adopted by the committee, and should you choose to, and it would be inconsistent with the Dash 7, which I'll describe momentarily. So should you choose to go with the Dash 7, you would need to do something about that inconsistency. The Dash 7 amendment incorporates the Dash 5 amendments and increases the threshold contract price to $250,000. Requires the beneficiary of contracting by proxy to comply with the Act, adds exemptions for diking districts, soil and water conservation districts, the Port of Portland, and procurements for client services, directs the state contracting agencies to request appropriations from the governor, substantially alters Section 4A at page 6, which directs the Oregon Department of Administrative Services to consult, evaluate effectiveness, and make a report to the Legislative Assembly on January 10, 2011. Removes requirements regarding the specific content of such a report. Removes a requirement for a second report. Removes a reporting requirement for contracting agencies. Modifies ORS 279B.420 regarding judicial review. Exempt construction manager general contractor procurements from prohibitions against contracting for administrative services with the parties to the contract to be administered, and makes other minor technical changes, which I believe will be explained.
And do we have all the fiscal and the others on this one?
We do not have a fiscal on the Dash 7 amendment.
And do we have a Ways and Means referral? We did have a...
We have a letter of referral to Ways and Means, so you could, suspend
the rules and send it to Ways and Means if we choose to do so. Okay. Ms. Unger, explain our...
Okay.
Chair Roblin, members of the committee, thank you for giving me this opportunity to testify today. My name is Melissa Unger, and I represent SEIU Local 503. And I actually come representing a broader coalition of people who have brought this bill forward. That includes the AFL-CIO, Democracy Reform, the Bus Project, AEE, which is the Association of Engineering Employees, the Oregon School Employees Association, the American Federation of Teachers, AFSCME, and then also Stand for Children, where I was going to testify but was had to leave early. So I just wanted to put that out there. And then I also want to take one quick second to thank Representative Roblin and his staff, Rosie, and also Representative Schaffler, because there's a lot of work has gone into this bill, and it's because of their efforts that it's continued. That work has been done and put into this bill. So having said that, I want to take a quick second and talk about what the Dash 7 amendments are. Those are the current, most current amendments coming out of the work group. And I'm not going to say that the work group came to consensus on this bill, but we did make drastic changes because of different opinions in the work group to make sure that actually fit into the contracting process. The bill does four things. It creates a process for a cost analysis and or feasibility finding for contracting services. This process is set up to make that sure that contracting decisions are being made with adequate information regarding costs and the feasibility of providing the service in-house or contracting the service. The cost analysis does ensure that contracting can't happen if the only savings come from lowering employees' wages and benefits. The second thing it does is it ensures that contracting agencies require a scope of work and expectations in their contracts. It requires that the standards are met or the contracting agencies can take actions such as asking them to redo the project or not paying them if the standards are not met. It also requires that the scope of work is to the highest standards in the industry. It also expands the responsible bidder guidelines to ensure that contracting agencies can look to a past record of performance, including looking at cost overruns and time overruns that were in actual control of the contractor. It also requires that, among other things, a contractor's criminal record when trying to get a contract or bid on a contract is taken into consideration when considering their integrity. And lastly, the bill requires that oversight, its surveyors, and inspection is done independently of contractors. So those are the four major areas of the contract. I want to take a second and talk about the cost analysis because that's a piece that our work group spent the most time talking about. I wrote this diagram because I thought it was an easier way. I think it just got passed out to you of kind of being able to look at what the cost analysis actually does. We made a lot of changes to this process. And so a personal service contract, when a contracting agency is looking at a personal service contract for over $250,000, they would embark on this cost analysis feasibility finding process. We did include a variety of exemptions in the Dash 7 amendments that had not previously been in. That includes exempting smaller local contracting agencies of cities and counties in special districts. And while I think the proponents of the bill believe that all agencies should, no matter the size, go through a process before they contract, we did understand that the concern about having them, so we did exempt them in this process. So the first step is that you have a personal service contract for $250,000. You would first do a feasibility finding to determine if it's feasible to do that work in-house. Do you have the expertise? Do you have the experience? Do you have the time available? If it turns out that you don't have these things, then you can proceed to contract and you can do a finding that you don't have the ability to provide these services in-house. If it is determined that you can provide these services in-house, then you would do a cost analysis. And it's at that point that you would do a cost analysis. And the three things that would happen in the cost analysis is that if it's determined to be the cheaper option to contract, you could proceed to contract if it's for a variety of factors. If it's determined to contract is more expensive, then the agency would provide that service in-house with some options if they didn't have adequate staff. If the contract is determined to be cheaper only, solely because the contractor pays lower wages and benefits, then the contracting agency would provide that service in-house. So that's kind of the contracting cost analysis feasibility process. While I think that this may be a new take on a process for some contracting agencies, it should not be a new process. A cost-benefit analysis is recommended in the best contracting practices by the National Association of Auditors. And so we believe that many contracted agencies do some version of this, and that this actually just sets up a pretty clear process in law for that process. So I'm going to quickly wrap up because I think there's other people. But, you know, I think that a couple of the questions I've been asked about this bill is, why should we do this now? And I think that we're in a tight budget situation, and our members know that better than most. And as they watch their agencies get cut and face significant layoffs and furlough days, they believe that our state is wasting money on contracts that could be better spent. And we want to make sure that there's a process in place where they can review this, review contracts. So that's why we believe it should be done now. So that's kind of a quick overview of the bill. I can answer questions. I did provide a frequently asked questions sheet that has a variety of information and a section-by-section analysis that literally just says what section-by-section the bill does, whether it has the cost analysis or the feasibility finding or the piece regarding quality and responsible bidder guidelines. And to just touch on the responsible bidder guidelines, that's a piece that I think we have the most consensus around, but it would make sure that it defines a satisfactory record of performance and a record of integrity. So that is what I've got. Thank you very much.
Are there any questions? Representative Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Melissa, how is, you've been using the term contracting out. Is that the language that's used in the bill? And what's kind of the definition of contracting out?
Yeah, it's actually, Chair Roblin and Representative Edwards, it's when they go to contract for a service. And so when they're going to go contract for a service that would cost $250,000, that's when this cost analysis and feasibility finding would be triggered. And services are kind of, there's a wide definition of services. It does exclude some services, like client services, like doctors and therapists and nurses. But it's like if they were going to go look at contracting IT services that would cost over $250,000, they may not be contracting out a job, but they would be contracting out a service, and they would look at what's the most cost-effective way to provide that service. So it may be to provide that service with in-house staff, or maybe to contract to provide that service. There's a piece in the bill that allows agencies that don't have adequate staff to perform the services to track that information so that the legislature can get more information about, you know, does it cost more to contract? And are we doing that because we don't have staff? So maybe we should look at adding staff so that we can be saving resources by adding staff instead of contracting.
Yep. So I was at a state park this last weekend, and they have a gift shop there, and at this particular state park, that's a bad example because of where their funds come from, but I'm trying to think of instances where you have this something that's ancillary to the actual function of say in this instance a state park, although that's not a great example, and let's say they want to close the gift shop altogether, and there's some of the local gift shops around the area are now going to sell stuff that was previously sold in that gift shop. Maybe not by contract, but I mean, that's what I'm just trying to get a general sense of. What this means.
Yeah, Tier Roland, Representative Edwards. I don't know if I can talk to that particular example, but let me give you an example that was brought up.
It's a bad
to
example.
Me. Yeah, brought up to me early on. ODOT, one of the reasons in the original bill there was no feasibility finding piece of this bill. And so ODOT came forward and said, hey, let's talk about the way that we do licenses. We contract out a piece of the work on how we produce Oregon licenses, but that work we couldn't provide that service. And so what we did is we entered this feasibility finding where you could say, we can't provide that service, and it's a finding, and then you wouldn't have to go through the cost analysis piece. So that service isn't something they could provide in-house. It's not something that they have the ability to do, but we didn't want, and so that's why we created this feasibility finding. I don't know if that quite gets to your question, but that's a piece of how we've tried to make sure that, you know, things that the agency can't provide or that they would no longer, that they wouldn't be forced to go through this cost analysis process if they can't actually provide the service. And I don't know if that relates to the gift shop analogy, but it's the kind of the example I have in my mind about. And we also, I think when we met, we talked about the example around the Autism Commission. And, you know, I think there's lots of different examples of when this, the feasibility finding will come into place.
I would guess, from my perspective, one of the areas that you were talking about would be rest areas on I-5.
Mm-hmm.
We have maintenance crew that takes care of those, and they probably also take care of the restrooms and that kind of stuff. And they might decide, you know, we've got so much maintenance to do that we really don't have time to do all of the daily taking care of the bathroom facilities and stuff. So we want to contract out because mm-hmm. there's a group that will just come and take care and make sure that the toilet paper's in the place and the restroom's cleaned up. And so that's when you would make a cost analysis to decide whether or not we should be able to contract out just that portion of it, because we want to keep our people out there taking care of the grounds, mm-hmm. fixing the buildings, doing all that kind of stuff. But we don't have the people right now to do another, so we do a cost analysis to see if they might want to do it. And that would be a personal service contract. Okay, any other questions for Melissa? Seeing none. Chris Myers, Dana Hepper, and... we might as well get Scott Wickers up as well.
Kara Robel and Dana had to leave. Dana
oh, okay.
had to leave early just later.
Okay. Scott? Yep.
Is personal service contract defined?
Yeah, sadly, it's different in different organizations.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Ready? Okay. Yeah. Chair Roblin and members of the committee, thank you for having us here today. My name is Chris Myers. I'm here speaking on behalf of the Association of Engineering Employees of Oregon. AEE is a public union, or public employee union. It represents 1,070 employees in the Oregon Department of Transportation, Oregon Department of Forestry, and the Oregon Parks and Rec Department, who work in engineering and related professional and technical classifications. AE believes it's important to pass House Bill 2867 for many reasons. The most important reason is to ensure that agencies and jurisdictions that contract for services do so using the best practices to make certain that the best value is achieved for the dollars that are spent. House Bill 2867 will codify the process to be followed by state agencies, counties, cities, school districts, and other jurisdictions. Accountability is a prime factor. Also, under these new provisions, selection of contractors can be based on past performance rather than just on the low bid. AEE believes that the first place to look for the necessary expertise and manpower for public work is within the agencies and jurisdictions themselves. Too often, agencies have contracted for services without taking the time to do a proper analysis. This has resulted in increased costs to the agencies and thus passing those costs on to the taxpayers of Oregon. AEE members are ready, willing, and able to do the work that is currently being contracted out. They would much rather be doing the technical and professional work needed by the agencies instead of administering consultant contracts for the work that these members used to do themselves. When work does have to be contracted out, inspection, oversight, and evaluations will no longer be able to be performed by the contractor doing the work. This ensures the conflict of interest will no longer impact the quality, safety, and lifespan of Oregon's highway and bridge projects. Passing House Bill 2867 is a vital step towards saving taxpayer dollars. It has been clearly shown by an audit performed by the Secretary of State and a study performed by the University of Oregon that it is at a minimum 20% more expensive for ODOT to contract out the engineering work they need done compared to having it done by in-house staff. AE is asking this committee to move this bill forward and support its passage when it reaches the floor of the House and then on in the Senate. Happy to answer any questions.
We'll go on to our Scott first and then...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Scott Winkles, representing the League of Oregon Cities. I'm appearing in opposition to House Bill 2867. While there have been some significant changes of legislation that do offer some improvements, the League still cannot offer its support. We believe there are still technical flaws, and there are some broader philosophical issues the League has with this legislation. From the League's perspective, the most significant issue with the bill is the way the cost analysis is conducted. It's designed in such a way that it'll require local governments to make determinations on cost estimates that will not be accurate. I can draw your attention to line 7 of page 3 of the Dash 7 amendments. The contracting agency will still be required to make a cost estimate based on data that will vary widely among prospective contractors. Things like credit risk, credit ratings, risk experience on both tort and workers' compensation insurance, purchasing contracts, wages, benefits, all go into the costs incurred by the contractor. But the league has not found a reliable method for calculating to figure out what all these variables will be. So essentially, we would have to look at what we believe a cost would incur when making the cost analysis, and then make the determination based on those estimates without actually getting any input in from a contractor. We believe that this is going to result in decisions made on faulty data. That is the way the legislation is designed. Secondly, I would also like to touch on some of the way the exemptions are written. Well, it's certainly useful that cities underneath 15,000 in population will be exempted from the bill. We have to question as to why a special district serving 500,000 customers would be exempted, but a city serving 25,000 residents wouldn't be. We would regard the growing list of exemptions from the bill as some form of acknowledgement that there may be some risks associated and drawbacks to this legislation, and we would urge extreme caution in moving forward before applying this to local governments. We recognize that there may have been some issues on the state side in regards to engineering, and there have been some well-publicized IT issues. But from the local government perspective, if we want to address public contracting, we would suggest doing it the way it was done last time, a multi-session process that had everybody at the table for a long period of time. All of the potential unintended consequences were explored. It was a very thorough process, and the league would be happy to participate in such a long-term endeavor. Lastly, on the philosophical side of this issue, however we look at this bill, however we change some of the technical aspects of it, there's still a fundamental intrusion on the local, the ability of a local elected official to make decisions that are best for their community. The League of Oregon Cities understands that preemptions are inevitable in some places, but we would regard those as issues of public safety, health threats to public health, things of that nature. We haven't heard articulated a public risk of that magnitude to warrant this sort of an intrusion on local decision-making authority. With that, I'm open to your questions.
Any questions for these two witnesses? Seeing none, thank you both. Is there anyone else who wishes to speak to this bill? Seeing none, we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2867, and I'm going to open a work session on 2867 for a couple purposes. First, I think the Dash 7s are definitely an improvement from my perspective to the Dash 5s. We've already put the Dash 5s in, so we need to move the Dash 7s.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 7s dated 5-26-09 into House Bill 2867.
Representative Edwards moves the Dash 7 amendments into 2867, and I want to explain that that actually replaces the whole bill, so it replaces the Dash 5s completely. And it does that. So is there any discussion? Is there any disagreement with doing so? Seeing none, so ordered. Now, if we want to move this bill, we're going to have to suspend the rules. We don't have the fiscal. We know it has one. It's going to be a relatively large one. I have heard that, and that's probably why it's taken a while. So I do have a letter to send it to Ways and Means, because I think that's the appropriate place for this bill to go. The fiscal will get there in time for them to look at that. So if that's okay with people, I would entertain a motion to suspend the rules.
Mr. Chair, let me get this wording right. I move the rules be suspended for purpose of voting on House Bill 2867 without the fiscal and or revenue impact statement being available for review.
Okay. Representative Edwards has moved that the rules be suspended for the purpose of voting on House Bill 2867 without the fiscal revenues impact statements being available for review. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection?
Discussion.
Representative Jensen.
Non-debatable.
It's non-debatable. I'm sorry, it's non-debatable. This is just the suspending of the rules.
Okay. I'll keep my mouth shut.
All right. Are you okay with that, the suspending? Okay.
And I think you should take roll.
Okay. We can take roll on that one, suspending the rules.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
Excused.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Excused.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Roblin?
Aye. Motion passes. So now,
we'll go back to the motion.
Okay.
So now you would like a motion to refer it to
Ways and Means.
To Ways and Means.
For the due pass.
For the due pass recommendation. To the floor with the subsequent.
Right.
Okay. So, Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2867 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Representative Edwards moves that House Bill 2867, as amended, be... thanks. To the floor with a, as amended, to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Discussion. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure where I'm going to be at on this particular bill, and if we were voting straight up on it right now, I'd vote against it. With a large fiscal, I'm even more unsure of what may be the results when it gets to Ways and Means. I will, however, not oppose the motion to send it to Ways and Means, but I would advise that I may not be supportive of it there, whether it's in a sub or whether it's in the full Ways and Means that I sit on. So.
Okay. I appreciate that.
Okay.
Thanks. Any other discussion? Seeing none, we'll take a roll call vote.
Representative Gerard?
Aye.
Representative Gelser?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Nolan?
Excused.
Representative Reed?
Aye.
Vice Chair Berger?
Excused.
Vice Chair Edwards?
Aye.
Chair Roblin?
Aye. Motion passes, and we will send it to Ways and Means. We are getting very close. Well, it's after 5. But there's a lot of people here who came to testify, and if it would be difficult for them to be back on Friday where we will transfer these bills, I would like to know ahead of time. We can take their testimony. So if there's anyone who would have a difficult time in any of these other bills being back on Friday, I don't see anyone that says they can't. So with that, I'll go through the motion of making sure that I do all this. First, I'm going to close the work session that we had open on House Bill 3004, so we'll close that one, and we will carry over the work session of 3004 to Friday. Hopefully we will get the paperwork we were waiting for that one.
Did you close this one?
And I will close the
2867.
The work session on 2084, and then House Bill 3240. Which is the ballot postage bill, we will move over.
Let's just say something.
She has something. We're gonna move it over to Friday. We've already done 3004. We will also move over to Friday. The House Bill 3232, Health Licensing Board, there's a number of amendments. It's all ready to go. We'll move that hearing and the work session over to Friday. SCR 15, we'll move over to Friday. And SB 560, we will also move over to Friday. And I think that takes care of all of the bills that we had. Yes, Representative Gerard.
Just a note that Representative Jensen and I sit on Ways and Means, and they have just called for a meeting on Friday at 5 o'clock.
Okay.
So
we may not get through all those bills, and I'll try to see where we're at. So.
That was nice of them.
And we really appreciate... You're adding 3 or 4 more bills
to our workload.
Yes.
We really appreciate that.
And as many of you know, I sat in an education committee just before I got here, and they sent a couple more to us.
And I just wanted to say how pleased I was that Representative Roblin was so gracious to accept those, and because he was so gracious, we sent one to Ways and Means also.
That's true. And so, as you know, most of the other committees are closing down. Tomorrow is the last day for most of them, and so I anticipate our workload. We have permission to start going daily next week. I'm still working and trying to get earlier, but we have so many people in Ways and Means and others that will do some things, and my hope is that we can maybe work really hard through Thursday and then Friday not have to be here. So that would be an easier way to do things for people, but no guarantees yet. With that, did she have anything? So with that, we're going to close our rules hearing, and thank you very much.